Today's podcast is a special episode that was recorded live during the 2024 NASA Investor Education Training. We talked with the representatives from the Ontario Securities Commission and discussed the downfall of crypto asset trading platform Quadriga. Clients entrusted their assets to Quadriga, which provided false assurances that those assets would be safeguarded. In reality, Quadriga CEO Jerry Cotton spent, traded, and used those assets at will. Jerry Cotton was able to misuse clients' assets for years, unchecked and undetected, ultimately bringing down the entire platform. So hello and welcome to the 2024 NASA Investor Education Training live recording of the Real Life Regulators podcast. This podcast series is brought to you by the North American Securities Administrators Association, also known as NASA. This podcast was created to educate investors using real-life examples of security fraud cases. During each episode, we review different cases and discuss what went wrong, how you can identify the warning signs of securities fraud, and what you can do in the future to protect yourself and loved ones from a similar situation. First, we need to go over some housekeeping rules for producing the best podcast episode. First, quiet on the set. Two, a fixed chair is a must to prevent rocking back and forth. Three, make sure to restart your computer an hour beforehand and allow any updates to take place and conduct a sound check the day of. Thank you, James. And number four, turn off notifications on your computer and make sure cell phones are silent. Number five, now on with the show. So I'm your host, Nick Bondrew, and I'm the Education and Public Affairs Manager for the Alabama Securities Commission. My co-host today is Lynn Peters, Director of Communication, Financial Education, Outreach for the Washington Department of Financial Institutions.
Also joining us today is Katrina Gustafson, Case Lead, Senior Litigation Counsel, Daniel Taranjo, Case Lead, Senior Forensic Accountant, and Cosmin Kazan, Crypto Case Lead, Senior Investigator, all of whom work at the Ontario Securities Commission. Before we get into the case, let's start off with our folks up in Canada telling us a little about yourselves. Katrina, let's go ahead and start with you.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, Nick. I'm a senior litigation counsel with the Ontario Securities Commission in the enforcement branch. I've been with the commission since 2019. And I was the senior counsel on the Quadriga case that we'll be talking about today.
Thank you, Katrina. Daniel?
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Nick. My name is Daniel Taranjo. I'm a case lead and senior forensic accountant at the Ontario Securities Commission. I've been also there for about 5 years, and I was the senior forensic accountant on the Quadriga matter.
Thank you, Daniel. I apologize for having butchered your name. Cosmin?
Hi, Lynn. Hi, Nick. I am a crypto case lead and a senior investigator in enforcement branch. I joined the enforcement branch in 2019. I was actually on a secondment coming from the market regulation branch where I was doing direct oversight of equity and derivatives exchanges. And actually, this one was my first file in enforcement.
Wow. Thank you very much. And let's get into the case.
So the subject of this case is Gerald, or sometimes known as Jerry Cotton, and his cryptocurrency trading platform, Quadriga CX. Can you briefly describe this case?
Yeah, as you say, Quadriga was a crypto asset trading platform, and it was founded and operated by Gerald Cotton, who was a Canadian. And it had a uniquely Canadian outlook. It catered to Canadian clients and had a lot of Canadian and a lot of Ontario investors. It started operating in 2013, and then it collapsed in early 2019, shortly after Gerald Cotton died honeymooning in India. So in the aftermath of the collapse, the enforcement branch of the Ontario Securities Commission started looking into it to try to figure out what had happened and what impact the collapse had had on investors. And what we found was that Cotton had committed a massive fraud, which I'm sure we'll be discussing in some detail today.
And we understand this is a really high profile case, so much so that it's received a lot of interest from the media. I watched the Netflix documentary, Trust No One is what it's called, just in case. And I found out today it's a topic of a multi-episode CBC podcast as well. Can you tell us about the coverage that this case has received in the time?
From the onset, the case brought a lot of media attention because there was a lot of speculation as to what truly had happened. There were questions as to whether the assets existed but could simply not be accessed, whether it was fraud. No one really knew. And as you just mentioned, there was a lot of aftermath. In the aftermath, a lot of media attention once. We uncovered what truly had happened. The CBC, Netflix took interest into the topic and turned them into documentaries.
So let's talk a little bit more about the subject of this case, Jerry. Can you tell us a little bit about like where he was originally from?
Mr. Cotton grew up in Belleville, Ontario. It's a town of about 50,000 people. It's located roughly about 2 hours away, 2 hour drive east of Toronto, Ontario. But then he later moved to Vancouver, British Columbia, and he founded Quadriga CX when he was there.
How old was Jerry?
He started Quadriga CX when he was in his mid-20s, and he was 30 years old at the time of his death. He was recently married when he died.
So he was married. Did he have like any other family around?
At the time of his death, to our knowledge, he did not have family around. However, he had his parents who were in Canada at the time he was traveling and passed away in India.
Can you describe for our audience here what Jerry looked like? Because when you think of somebody who founds a large company like this, you may not think of what he looked like.
He looks like a very average person who can easily blend in. He was wearing glasses, had somewhat dirty blonde hair, average height. There was really nothing remarkable about Jerry Cotton's appearance.
So before he founded Quadriga, can you tell us a little bit about his professional background?
Yeah, we knew a little bit of his professional background. He had a bachelor degree in business administration, but other than that, there was little on his professional background.
So as far as you know, he never had like a standard 9 to 5 kind of job.
Not to our knowledge, and not during the period he was operating Quadriga.
So, what kind of businesses was he involved with previously?
He appears to have been involved with other smaller businesses involving cryptocurrencies prior to founding Quadriga. However, those previous activities were not part of our investigation.
And I believe you mentioned that you learned about this case once Jerry died, correct?
That's right. It was not the death so much, but it was the subsequent collapse and bankruptcy of the platform that really got our attention. And as you pointed out, Lynn, it made headlines not just in Canada, but globally. So that naturally caught our attention as well. And that's when we started looking into what had happened.
So this is the first podcast that we have covered that involves cryptocurrency. So for our listeners, can you simply describe what cryptocurrency actually is?
I'll try, and I'll try to keep it simple. I'm sure that many people probably already know of blockchains and other crypto assets, but just in case, a blockchain is a network of computers that store the same version of a digital ledger. And this digital ledger keeps track of who owns what of an asset that is called crypto or digital asset. This crypto asset is native to the blockchain. In other words, it does not exist anywhere else, either in a physical form or digital form. It's simply on that particular blockchain. For example, the Bitcoin blockchain is basically a large network of computers that use the same public ledger, digital ledger, keeping track of all the transactions involving Bitcoin. So the Bitcoin history started in 2009 with the first transactions. So if you have a copy of this ledger, you basically can see all the transactions in Bitcoin since 2009 to current day. This way, all wallet software can be used to determine what is the balance on a specific wallet at any point in time. And I would say, lastly, the main difference between this type of ledger and a ledger that a financial institution would use is that there's no names associated with a wallet in Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency. It's simply a string of characters. It's similar to a user ID, like a random user ID. And maybe one more note on the word crypto. It's called crypto because there's a process that involves certain elements of cryptography and encryption in keeping and maintaining this distributed digital ledger. That would be, I know it's probably sounds complicated, although I try to simplify it as much as possible. But let me know if you have any other
That's a good
questions.
explanation, and we thank you for that. So, easier question. What was Quadriga? How would you describe that?
Quadriga was, as my colleagues mentioned, was a platform, a crypto trading platform, where users can exchange. Can buy and sell Bitcoin and other crypto assets and trade among themselves and exchange these assets as they want it.
So during this time, was it hard for Canadians to purchase cryptocurrency?
During this time, there were not many options in Canada to purchase crypto assets, in particular when someone would try to do it using Canadian dollars. There were a few of other crypto trading platforms available in Canada, but it's safe to say that Quadriga was the most popular and probably option number one because it was already functioning for a longer period of time than others and was also perceived without actually like concrete reasons as trustworthy by Canadians and other users, non-Canadians as well. I would say maybe this blind trust was based on things like a simple website that highlighted the fact that the business is based in Canada, was fairly well designed. It had the trading platform itself, it had quite a high volume compared to the other options out there. Meaning that you are able to buy and sell Bitcoin and other crypto assets fairly straightforward and easy.
So, how many people did it take to operate Quadriga?
Quadriga was a one-man operation from the beginning. When things start getting busier for the mastermind, the founder, Mr. Cotton, he started adding additional members to the team. His first member, and we call them contractors, was the person that helped with designing the platform and the trading engine, but also the back end of the website that Mr. Cotton used to manage his operations. At a peak, he had a handful of operators that were helping him with managing customer requests and questions.
So, about how many crypto users were actually using Quadriga, and what were the demographics?
By 2019, there were more than 300,000 unique accounts on Quadriga. For example, we know that at the end, there were about 76,000 users that were owned more than 200 million in assets. And about 95% of all the users were Canadian. The rest were a mix of users around the world, without a specific, there were Americans as well, of course.
And our understanding is there's different kinds of cryptocurrency or different name brands of cryptocurrency. Which one was being used by Quadriga or many?
The most popular was Bitcoin. Then in 2005, on 2015, when Ethereum was launched, became the second most traded asset. So as an example, about 82% of the volume traded on Quadriga platform were in either Bitcoin or Ethereum.
And just for the simple fact that you guys are here to talk about Quadriga, obviously something went wrong later on, but was this a legitimate crypto trading platform?
It was not. So Quadriga was not registered in any capacity that would allow it to keep, store, and use its users' money and crypto assets. And most importantly, it did not keep this money and assets safe and intact. The founder and the mastermind, Mr. Cotton, was instead using these funds for personal means, or simply using them in losing trades on Quadriga itself or other crypto trading platforms.
So at the beginning, were people still able to successfully withdraw funds? Like we know they were buying it, could they get their money back at least at the beginning?
Absolutely. From the onset, from 2014, when they started, and as they progressively grew, there were no issues that we know of or that we found with users struggling or not being able to withdraw their funds or cryptocurrencies. It's really starting in early 2018 that problems started for Quadriga.
So what were the problems?
Up to December 2017, the platform kept attracting new users and therefore as well new capital because the price of cryptocurrencies kept increasing at a very fast pace, especially in 2017. Therefore, it was hiding the true nature of the activities that Gerald Cotton, and really it was hiding the losses that he was sustaining. And then two major events occurred pretty much concurrently. In mid-December 2017, crypto prices did plummet, and they plummeted very quickly. Demand for crypto was therefore slowing. There were less new users, and Quadriga clients were actually selling and cashing out. At this pretty much almost at the same time, in January 2018, a Canadian bank froze the accounts of one of Quadriga's main payment processors, rendering $26 million Canadian, roughly $20 million US, unable to they were unable to access them. Quadriga could not access these funds anymore. And these funds remained frozen until after Mr. Cotton's death. And it's following those events that Quadriga began to struggle fulfilling the withdrawal requests.
And what were users told about this when they were not able to take their money out?
Users were usually told that it would be temporary. In reality, what was happening is that Cotton was waiting for new or existing users to fund their accounts. And by a few months after, pretty much by March 2018, Cotton was effectively operating Quadriga like a revolving door. In other words, Canadian dollars, American dollars, and crypto assets that were being deposited by clients to fund their accounts were immediately rerouted, often within the same day or 24 hours, to fund withdrawals by their clients.
And we know that when Jerry passed away, there were still some issues going on. But what did Jerry or a Quadriga representative, did they ever publicly address the issue of the users not being able to withdraw their funds? Or what were they told?
Yes, when Mr. Cotton was still alive, Mr. Cotton would publicly blame the withdrawal problems on the bank that froze some of the funds. But in reality, that was only a small part of a much larger asset shortfall, that was mainly caused by Cotton's fraudulent trading on the platform. Now, after Mr. Cotton passed away, then the narrative was changing as they believed that they could simply not access the people up taking over the operations, did not understand where the assets were, did not understand as well what had happened. So they were saying, well, we'll locate the assets and it's just a matter of locating them.
So knowing that users weren't, the Quadriga users were not getting the answers they wanted to hear from Quadriga, were they talking to each other?
They were talking on social media, and they were talking, I mean, depending when, over time, the comments were positive, and that led to more users joining Quadriga. And then towards the end, when obviously there were issues, they were expressing their concerns and trying to raise issues and find out if others had faced similar issues. For a time, the contractors that Mr. Cotton were hired, they were responsible for responding and keeping a communication open with these users on social media, which sort of points to the fact that he was concerned about Quadriga's image and wanted to keep that trust out there so more users come instead of leaving, which would expose his fraud.
So, were they hopeful on getting their funds back?
They were up until the point where his death was communicated. They were hopeful. Similar to what Daniel said, they were blaming any delaying issues on the banking system not cooperating with Quadriga.
So it sounds like this is like his death is when everybody kind of went, oh, we have a problem. Danger, Will Robinson. How did this come about? Can you tell us a little bit about his death? We understand he was in India. What was he doing there?
He was on an extended honeymoon. They got married in the summer of 2018, and India was a stopover the summer. And then in the fall of 2018, they had a large event, a wedding event in Scotland. They rented a castle specifically for this event. And then in December, they used India as a stopover before getting to New Zealand and Australia for a cruise.
So you had mentioned that, Jerry was married around this time. What did Jerry's wife know about the Quadriga operation as a company? And was she ever found to be involved with any of this?
It seems to us that Mr. Cotton's wife knew little at the beginning, at least, about what Mr. Cotton was doing, the details of his business. At one point, he was helping him on certain activities, so basically working as a contractor for him, similar as the other members. She was with him when he died, but apparently he was using the laptop with him to control everything. And the moment he died, she did not have any access to all the records on that particular laptop.
So that kind of goes to my next question of like, we know that Jerry's death was sort of the catalyst for the downfall of everything. What exactly were the complications involved with that, with not just Jerry's wife not knowing what was going on, but his company?
Yeah, so the moment Mr. Cotton died, basically any access to the crypto asset wallets that he was controlling and using was lost, meaning that any assets were still there available for users' withdrawal requests were not available anymore. So that was a big important thing that contributed to the final bankruptcy of Quadriga.
So, how fast did the news spread concerning Jerry's death?
The news spread very fast. Within a day, was picked up by news websites, by all the social media. Was a headline the day and the days after.
So, what kind of conspiracy theories came up around his death as a result of this, from all of the people who were losing money like crazy?
Well, for a long time, starting in January 2019. Many people believe that it was a fake death as a means basically for Mr. Cotton to justify his running away with users' money. The community was familiar with past cases where there were examples of founders of crypto-related businesses, including trading platforms like Quadriga, where the founders basically disappeared, together with access to these crypto wallets and basically all the assets that were users' assets. So many tried to look at all the aspects of his last trip, trying to put together all these pieces, just to show that Cotton used it as an exit from Quadriga.
And
We,
about
of
how?
course,
Oh,
we
sorry.
had no evidence of such a thing, and our evidence points to him being dead.
So, about how much money was in Quadriga at the time of his death?
Users had an aggregated basis at a total of over $200 million owed to them. That's approximately $150 million. But the platform actually had almost no assets, and it filed for bankruptcy shortly after Cotton's death. Is that really just exposed Quadriga's already dire financial situation?
So overall, you figured there was how much was lost? 150 million US, 200 million Canadian?
What was owed was 200 million, but eventually, although investors lost about $170 million Canadian, or approximately 120 $120 million US.
And to step back real quick, if anybody didn't catch the part earlier in today's session about do you know where your records are? Does somebody else know where your records are? Get a pretty good case for writing down records and having some succession planning, maybe, even if you are running a Ponzi scheme.
So how did Jerry lose so much money?
Well, to understand why he lost that money, we have to understand what really happened. So from Quadriga's inception, that started in December 2013, Cotton traded with Quadriga clients using numerous aliases, alias accounts, which he credited with fake assets. In other words, with simply a few keystrokes, he could make any amount of fake money or crypto assets appear in his alias accounts. And he regularly did so, crediting his accounts of hundreds of millions of dollars, okay, fake funds that he then used and for trading with unsuspecting clients of the Quadriga platform. The problem, and that's how he ended up losing so much money, is that his positions were accumulating significant losses. He was finding himself on the wrong side of the trades. And when he was losing money, he had to use, well, he ended up using other clients' platforms' assets to pay out clients with whom he had traded, creating a shortfall between the total amount owed to clients and the pool of funds actually available. And that differential kept growing until there were literally no real assets left. So what Cotton did really, he perpetrated a fraud on his client, on his clients, and that's why users could not gain access to their assets. They were no longer held by Quadriga, these assets. A majority of them was lost in trading, and others were used for personal use by Cotton.
So what was Jerry actually? I know that he was a terrible trader, but what was he spending the money on? Did he have a lavish lifestyle, big houses, fancy cars, any of those types of things?
Short answer is yes. What Cotton did is that he bought a Tesla, a Lexus, a luxury yacht, a plane, a share in a private jet, and multiple properties. Most of these properties were able to be recovered, and along with the frozen funds that the Canadian bank had frozen back in January 2018, this was the bulk of the money that was recovered. They were almost the only assets left, and that's why the users of the platform didn't lose everything. Mr. Cotton was also traveling a lot, and we had learned during our investigation that he was sort of boasting that he had traveled to 56 countries by mid-2018. Of course, the lavish lifestyle was funded with Quadriga clients' assets that he had fraudulently misappropriated.
So what would you say was Jerry's end game in all of this?
His end game, whether it was to seek profit, generate volume on the platform, bolster liquidity, or anything like that, because we don't exactly know what his motives were because he had passed away, so we could not interview him. But what he did had catastrophic effect on the Quadriga's finances, and ultimately it brought down the entire platform because his trading position sustained such severe losses.
So would you classify this as a traditional Ponzi scheme?
A Ponzi scheme, as you know, is not a legal term. It's a term we use to describe a particular kind of fraud. And it's a kind of fraud where, investors think they're investing in some kind of a real investment scheme. But what's happening in reality is that their deposits are just being used to satisfy the withdrawals of earlier investors. The operators of the scheme take a cut. And eventually, these schemes unravel because, without a constant inflow of deposits, the ability to satisfy withdrawals dries up. For all the reasons Daniel has explained, Quadriga didn't start out as a Ponzi. It started out as an actual crypto trading platform. But by 2018, that's what it had become because there were insufficient assets to satisfy all the withdrawal demands. So, as Daniel described, it was just a revolving door. New deposits were being immediately rerouted to fund withdrawals. In other words, a Ponzi.
Thank you. So, this is the portion where we typically talk about legal proceedings. But with Jerry passing away, I'm guessing there were no legal proceedings.
Not by the commission. Of course, there was a bankruptcy proceeding, but normally we would have taken enforcement action in a massive fraud like this. But Quadriga was in bankruptcy, and Jerry had passed away. And as Cosmin pointed out, it was a kind of a one-man show. So there really wasn't an enforce a realistic enforcement action to carry forward. So what we did instead is we published a report detailing our findings, and the goal of that was to explain what had happened and to hopefully help to prevent the same kind of thing happening in the future.
So were there any funds recovered? You had mentioned, the properties, the yacht, the plane, things like that. Were any investors able to receive funds?
Yes, as Daniel explained, the trustee was able to recover some funds and liquidate properties, but ultimately investors received about 13% of what they were owed by Quadriga.
And I think you pretty much already made this clear, but with Jerry passing away, there really wasn't anyone else to be held responsible for the collapse of Quadriga, correct?
That's right. I mean, it was the facts that we uncovered would not have justified an enforcement action against anybody else.
And did his wife, relatively new wife, from the sounds of it, they were on their honeymoon when he passed away. Did she get to keep anything?
As Daniel explained, the she engaged with the trustee and ultimately returned about $12 million in assets to the trustee, and that included a boat and an airplane.
So this now kind of brings us to the most important part of the podcast is how can, someone protect themselves from falling for a scam or becoming a victim from a scheme like this in the future?
I would say three main things. First, I think it's important for investors to understand that when they are using a crypto asset trading platform like this, they're taking a risk. And people understand that when they're trading crypto, they're taking, there's trading risk. They might lose their money by making bad trades. But often what happens, and what we found with respect to Quadriga, is investors don't understand, or at least don't have a sufficient understanding of the risks they take with the platform itself. that they're handing over their assets to the platform. They have very little insight in most cases into how those assets are being handled. And then they subject themselves to, proficiency risk, insolvency risk, risk of theft and fraud, the kinds of risks that we saw unfold in Quadriga. So that's the first point, is just to be aware of those risks. And then secondly, regulation. We see in the crypto asset world that some platforms engage with regulators, come into the regulatory fold, comply with the regulatory frameworks that are there, of course, to protect investors, and other platforms simply refuse to engage. So that's an important consideration, I would say, for investors. If you're handing over your crypto assets to a trading platform that believes it's above the law, you're taking on an added risk. So I would suggest investors inform themselves of the regulatory status of platforms they're considering investing in and any history of regulatory violations. Lastly, I would say that investors should, before they hand over their assets, do some due diligence and try to find out what they can about how the platform handles those assets and what its risk management policies are. This can be difficult because, as I said, you don't often have a lot of insight as an outside investor, and that's where the regulatory oversight becomes so important. And it's always important to look for signs of fraud. If a platform is making promises that seem too good to be true, they probably are. If you see out there that investors are having trouble getting their funds out of platforms, that's always a bad sign.
So you've ticked off a few of the warning signs that investors should be looking for: lack of regulation, not knowing how the platform's handling things. I mean, are there other things that you would say Quadriga investors might have been able to see as a warning sign prior to investing or during that period before it collapsed?
Well, look, the lack of regulatory oversight was a big one, but I would say that was it. In the early days, the framework was evolving, so it wasn't entirely clear where crypto platforms fit in to the framework. So that may have not been so apparent to investors. But then, of course, the trouble people had withdrawing their funds was a huge red flag.
So, is there a place that people that are interested in investing their crypto assets into a crypto platform, is there a place where investors can go independently to check to see if that platform is registered?
For sure, in Ontario, absolutely, and in the other Canadian securities jurisdictions. I imagine in the US as well. Our website lists the platforms that are registered with one of the Canadian provincial regulators. And of course, we also have an investor warning list, like many of our sister regulators, that would alert investors to platforms that should probably be avoided.
How can someone check the background of a person making an investment offer? Go to nasa.org, that's NASAA.org. Click the Contact Your Regulator tab located in the top right corner, and then simply click your jurisdiction or click Find Your Regulator located on the top of the map to obtain the contact information for your regulator. Being an informed investor means having a plan and understanding each of your investments. Whether you're new to investing or already investing, NASA and its members provide a variety of online investor education resources for investors of all ages. Visit nasa.org for more information on how to be a wise and safe investor. Again, that is NASAA.org. Thank you so much for joining us, and more importantly, thank you for the work that you do to protect the investors. And that's all from today and from Montgomery, Alabama, but Minneapolis today. I'm Nick Vondreau.
And from Olympia, Washington, but Minneapolis today, I'm Lynn Peters. If you have any questions about today's podcast or would like more information about the topics discussed, please email us at realliferegulators@gmail.com. That's realliferegulators, all one word, @gmail.com. If you'd like to hear future episodes, please hit the subscribe button.